So I'm here with Bernadette Schwert. It's the second week of our podcast. We haven't moved much from our perspective because it's only a few seconds later. But I know for the rest of you, it's a week later. The interesting questions, and it's interesting from your perspective. You know, in some ways, I mean, I've built my business. Well, I haven't, but you know, many of us have built the business, and so we've been party to an incredible journey. But I am jealous to a degree because the opportunity to interview all these characters who have created different businesses, who have come from different backgrounds, is there any kind of standout trait or common? So when someone is sitting there going, I don't know whether do I have it? Do I not have it? Will I have it? I don't know, because you know, I started my first company over 20 years ago, and I had no bloody idea. I had actually never had anyone work underneath me in a role prior to that as a recruitment consultant. So, is it something that it doesn't matter that you didn't have it in the beginning? What did you see when you met all these people?
I think that anyone can. I think there's got to be some qualifiers there. I think you have to really want it. You have to have a driving force as to why this is important to you, because you know the hiccups you've been through in business. If there's not a strong pull, it's enough to cut that tie and people just go, oh, I can't do it. It's too consuming. You know, it's too stressful. And so they give it away and they try. So millions of people give away their business. You know, how many businesses fail in their first year? So I think it's got to be a strong pull as to why you want it. I think the second thing is that the skill set, all sorts of people succeed. You know, you were an SEO guy, weren't you? You know, you were really strong in SEO and Google. So that was kind of that side. And there are other people, like take Jules Lund, for example. He's in the book. He set it up, Tribe, this social influencer platform. And he's a front guy. You know, he's a sales guy. He's very, you know, entertaining. He's been in media. And he has no technical knowledge whatsoever. And he's quite open about that. But he connected and collaborated with people who do have the tech skills. So I think, you know, you kind of know you have to know your strengths. And was it Socrates who said, know thyself? Just know what you're good at, what you're not good at, and try and bring in the bits that you're not. But I think where people get hung up is they think, I've got to be all things. I need to learn the tech. I need to learn how to build a website. I need to learn how to be a graphic designer. That's not going to happen. In this very fast-paced world, you don't have time to spend a year learning how to do a brochure. Go to Canva. You know, do something that you can either do it quickly or get someone else to do it. So I think the skill set, and like you look at people, who am I thinking of? Maybe, no one comes to mind, but they're very detail-oriented. You know, they love this. Oh, no, Simon Griffiths, who gives a crap, you know, the toilet paper, environmental toilet paper. He's a detail guy. He loves his spreadsheets. He's a calculating guy. So he loves all the numbers, you know. So I think you can be whatever you want to be, you know, focus on your strengths, but be aware that you need the front guy and you need the tech guy as well, or gal, to make the whole thing work.
So it must be, I mean, I know, Mark, did you ever meet Martin Hosking from Redbubble in your journey? He's a unique character because I get to meet them all. He is very, you can tell, even though I haven't spent time in his business, he's a detail guy. He's one that wouldn't walk into a room and be the life of the party. He's very personable and he and I get on well. But you can tell he likes to stay under the radar. And Redbubble is a $200 million business. It's huge. It's incredible. But when you think about that and you think about other businesses, then is it not then what you said before, understanding that there is the demand from, you know, at the end of the day, having the demand from customers to want to be able to participate in whatever they're doing is really where it all kind of meets and makes it happen. So it doesn't matter whether you're one personality or another. Mm. It's really about knowing that there is a demand there. And the bigger the demand and the greater demand, you end up with a business like Redbubble, which is internationally huge.
Yeah.
Before being an SEO guy, I'm a salesman and I've been a salesman for over 30 years. So selling is something that I feel really comfortable with. And if you're a salesperson, then you've got to understand the customer. And I came from a training, as did my brother-in-law, and my brother, to a lesser degree, who were on a business together, solution selling, which is really understanding the needs of the customer and then meeting the needs. So in recruitment, rather than just throwing as many resumes as you can and seeing what sticks, which was something that would have happened in the early days, probably not so much these days, but the quality of being a good recruiter is to go through all those resumes, meet those people, and understand whether they're a good cultural and a technical fit. I was in IT recruitment, and so therefore it was very important. So selling is something that I understand well. Did you find that a lot of there is all of them, no matter what kind of personality they had, they still understood the customer's needs? Is that,
you know, Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. You've got to understand what problem do you solve and create the product around that. The other way it can go too is people have a passion and they've seen something they would like to fix. You know, like one woman comes to mind is Sandy Abram, and she does a company called Wholesome Hub. And Sandy was a marketing person and a nurse, and she had a health issue. And she was believing that food is medicine. She really came to believe that that's the way she's going to fix her medical condition. And she couldn't find the food she wanted, you know, organic, vegan, GMO-free, all the things that she needed. And so she could find them, but you'd have to go to 3 or 4 different stores to get it. So she thought, wouldn't it be great if we had a website where you could buy products based on your values, based on your needs? So she set up this search functionality where if you want Australian made, click on that, and all the products show up as Australian made, kosher, fair trade, cruelty free, vegan. You just press a button and all those products pop up. So she wasn't reinventing the wheel in terms of products. She doesn't even make products. She, you know, brings them in. But it was the search functionality that was her point of difference. So she believed in it greatly. She knew that it was solving a need, and so she was able to sell it. But I think you've got to believe in it, don't you? You really have to believe it's going to fix some problem, or else you just, if you're just in it for the money, and I think obviously that's a good reason to be in business too, but you can run out of puff, I think, if you don't have that strong driving force as to why you think this is a valuable product.
That's interesting, yeah. So for those that are mercenary and they're in and out, that probably emanates through the whole organisation, I would suggest. Maybe that's why there's a banking royal commission going on right now. Who knows? So what other things then that you saw or you heard that maybe not didn't even make the book that were interesting that you thought is worth hearing about?
Yeah, I was really interested in artificial intelligence and the Internet of Things, mm-hmm. and how those technologies are being used by small business. I was really interested in, I'll give an example, like there's a real estate company in Adelaide who are using VR to do open inspections. And it's a really small idea, you know, it's not difficult to do. You just create the footage and you put your goggles on and you can walk your way through the house. But what I thought was really interesting was that's being used like an MVP now. And they're using it as a point of difference for them. They're going, we're the only company in Australia using VR for open inspections. And I know that's just going to explode. Because you think about, why would you turn up to a house at Thursday on a 6 o'clock at night, freezing cold, and walk away through a house when you can just put your VR goggles on and get an equal experience, even just in the early days of selecting a house? You think about all the agents who don't need to be standing there guarding the house. So I think it's a real game changer just for that industry, mm-hmm. VR. So I was very interested in that technology, even though it's quite highfalutin for a lot of and quite expensive to bring in. I'm really interested in small business, how they can use that. So I didn't get to put a lot of that in there because it's actually a topic in and of itself. Same with AI. I talked to Kevin Block, who's the chief technologist at Cisco. And I was just trying to get some examples from him about how is AI going to affect the everyday person. And he gave this great example of a radiologist and white-collar workers too, not just your traditional factory workers. He said, you think about a radiologist, they look at a scan and they're using their experience and their eye to pick out the tumours. He said, that's generally successful, but there's always going to be a few that just, you know, go through to the keeper, and that's dangerous. He said, when you've got machine learning and this machine can ingest 30 million images in an hour and then use all that learning to detect where is the tumour, where is the grey spot, he said, that's got to be more powerful than just one radiologist looking at a scan, mm-hmm. more accurate. And he said, that's happening. And so, therefore, a radiologist is under a lot of threat, really. Their role will change. They won't be just one scan, one radiologist, you know. They might be there to deliver the news to the patient, but the actual assessment will be done by the machine. So those sorts of things I was very interested in. How is it going to affect not just the traditional, you know, blue-collar worker, but the professionals who think they might be immune to this advancing of technology?
So that's interesting. So everyone is writing books all the time. You're an author. How often are you reading books and learning and going on your own personal educational journey? What do you do there?
I'm a news fiend. You know, I read every newspaper I can get.
Right.
And I read it every single day. And it's not because I have to. I just, it's my routine. I just start with the newspaper. If I haven't read the paper before the day begins, that's not a good day for me.
So is that a physical paper or an online
paper? It's hard copy.
Hard copy.
I really like the hard copy.
Right.
And that's just habit. And I have it delivered. Mm-hmm. And I got my little routine. And I work from home. So, you know, and often if I'm traveling, it's a different story. But if I don't like reading it on my phone or my iPad because for me that's work. And I spend a lot of time on the computer. I'm often at it writing. So any opportunity to be away from that is powerful. And the other reason I don't use it online is because when I get to the sport, that's my cutoff. It's like that and the cars. It's like now it's time to get to work. Now, so I use it as my little timer. So once I've read the early general news, the letters to the editor and the opinion page, that's my day. I'm off to work now. So it's kind of a inbuilt timer. And I read the obituaries too. That's what I get from my mum. She still reads the obituaries to see who's passed. So I get that. And also I like reading the obituaries because it helps me feel grateful for life, you know, and it helps me deal with fear too because I'm reading the obituaries going, we're all going to die. So why not give things a go? You know, why not have a crack and don't let fear stop you from doing something because we're all going to end up in the ground.
That's interesting too. So just in terms of, did you get a chance to, in your interviews or even perhaps on the when you're on the tour, the roadshow, when it was a live, when you're doing theatre sports, let's call it, were there anything in terms of personal, like were people, I mean, you showed your interest in the Carlton Football Club. Did you find that, though, that people had a lot of other interests? Were you able to explore that, or was it too focused to even find that out? Did you find that these people were obsessed with work, which my wife would probably think I am, even though she wouldn't because she knows I've got interests all over the place. But are they quite they're quite diverse? They get involved in many other projects, community things. What was it about those kind of personalities that someone who's listening going, okay, yeah, that's me, or it's not me, or
yeah, I didn't get a chance to speak too much to them about their outside business activities. One thing I would say is incredibly focused. You know, they've got one idea, one business, and they devote their time to that.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who've got multiple interests, multiple businesses, other than being an investor, which is a different sort of story, that's not always a recipe for success. You know, I find that people who've done extremely well are like you, where you go, this is my business and I'm going to focus on this for 20 years. And I think that is a really good hallmark to think about. And for those who've got the dabblers, if you like, and I do include myself a little bit in that, I've got a lot of interests and I probably wouldn't be successful just having one business for 20 years. I think I would struggle to do that. I think, but there's a cost to that too. You know, you're incredibly, look at this amazing business and the volumes that you turn over. To get to that level, you need to focus. You need to have that as a single-minded idea.
I don't, yes, you do. You do. And the more that Amazon is here, which they are now, the more that we focus on books, the clearer we get around our purpose rather than thinking, let's add more and more lines of products. So that's something that we decided to do perhaps even more so in the last 12, 18 months. So that is interesting. But I think where this conversation, where I'd like to take this conversation next, I think is really interesting for me. And you've probably got more content there than you would have shared in the book based on what you were telling before. Just around that personal sustainability in terms of taking care of yourself and being able to, like, there's been times in my business career where I literally felt, you know, I woke up in the morning and I went down to the petrol station, I put 3 litres of fuel in, that you made it through the day, and at the end of the day you're exhausted and you crashed out, and then you, and so you're constantly feeling like you're running on empty, and that's really unsustainable. Whereas today, one of the things that I have now, I think we're up to, I saw this month's financial report, I think 190 full-time equivalent employees. So there's casuals, and we've got a team in the Philippines, etc. There's a lot of people. So I don't feel like, you know, I'm burdened. There's a lot of people who are driving Booktopia to its destination, and they're empowered to do that. So I don't feel I've got the drive and the focus, but it's like being the captain of a very, very large ocean liner, and you're up there, and you know, how often are they standing there bloody with the wheel spinning it around? Probably not at all. They've got 8 or 10 people who stand there and manage all of that. So just in terms of that, because I think that's important. I've got some great interest in it, and I think others would have great interest. Just in terms of your well-being, which you said could be, you know, potentially book three, what are some of those things that we should be mindful of or doing to take care of ourselves?
I do think it's about priorities. I think it's getting really clear about what's important to you or the business owner. And maybe if family is number one, or maybe making money equals security, maybe two is adventure. You know, I did Tony Robbins years ago. I'm a big fan of Tony Robbins, and he was very big on priorities. If you know what your priorities are, then decision-making becomes really easy. Because if family's your priority and you're called into question about, well, you can either be there for your son's birthday or you go to a board meeting. Well, if your family is your priority, your decision's made. So, and I know it's not that simple generally, but I find that if you know your priorities, then even if you do have the family issue about the son's birthday and a board meeting, you say, well, family is important, but this on this day trumps the kid's birthday. You know, so on this occasion, I'm going to violate my values and do what I said I would never do, but I need to do it. But at least you're mindful of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're aware that you've made that decision and that you try not to do it consistently. I think where people go wrong is they're so focused on an outcome, and the cost that it is incurring to get there, at the end of the journey they see the litany of damage that's been done or the loss, and they think it wasn't worth it.
That's interesting. I mean, I'm sure I've got my family will have hundreds of examples to refer to there, but I think it's important in terms of, and I have a wife who accountability is like one of her highest priorities. I mean, being accountable, everyone to be accountable for themselves. So in that situation, it's rather than, which I perhaps would have done in the past, or other people who are listening would do, is that you get conflicted, and therefore you know that you've got two things that are clashing. You don't have you don't have the honesty around it to be able to communicate to your child to say, look, actually, I do have something on. I feel bad that I'm not going to be here, or whatever's appropriate, whatever's true for them. And this is hard for me not to be here, but I actually do need to go and do this meeting, and to make up for it, I'm going to do this. Is that okay? And are you going to be okay with that? You know, because I'll be thinking about you all the time, or, you know, I'll just have you on Skype on silent and I'll be watching all the time and you can wave at me. But like, you just, like, it's about having integrity around the process, which I think is really, really important. Otherwise, everything starts to erupt. And the emotion, and you do things to sabotage. You have an argument with your family, with your wife, or at work, because you didn't deal with it. And I think your awareness around what's going on for you, I think, is really important. That can serve us extremely well. So, what other things? I mean, you talked about meditation, or, you know, running, or eating. What other things have you seen or observed?
Yeah, I see that they generally, again, it's a complete generalization, but they're very mindful of the sustainability of themselves with the business. If they want to have, you know, a long-term business and be around, they've got to stay healthy, they've got to eat well, you know, they've got to take time out for that. And I do think mindfulness is a big game changer for a lot of people, and I think it's been around forever, of course, but incorporating it into the workplace now is lovely to see this development. And it's so simple, you know, it's 10 minutes at the beginning of the day, but simple is not easy, and people often just think, what could 10 minutes possibly do? But I know from my own experience, it just brings... the analogy I used for the Carlton guys was I brought in a snow dome. You know those snow domes? Mm-hmm. And I said, our brains are like the snow dome. And when you shake it, like an external event comes in and shakes you up, all the snow gets everywhere. And it's like your head's like that. And there's all this, you know, conflict. And if you meditate, the snow just slowly falls to the bottom of the dome and enables you to see clearly. You know, make better decisions in the split second that you need to make a decision on the field. Mm-hmm. You know, do you hit someone? Do you push the umpire? What do? You know, you've got to have that moment to make a decision. So I talked about that. And I do think that in the corporate sector, I'm seeing a lot more people interested in mindfulness. And I think that's a good thing.
Mm.
Yeah. But I think for every person who's got the mindfulness and the healthy eating, there's also the person who loves the hamburgers and the, the five beers after work as well. So I don't think there's any particular... unifying force there as to how people look after themselves.
I think for me, because at the moment I'm overweight, my goal is to lose weight and get back down into that. And I know that I use food for myself as the stress manager, which you know doesn't work for me in the long term. So everyone will have their personal battles, but it is important to understand. Where you're, you know, that you are stressed. Am I stressed? I am stressed. How can I de-stress and have trusted formula or template that you can use to just settle yourself? I think is really, really important. Do you think from your experience as well that you know that people have they come from? All backgrounds have they all had? I mean, most people have hardships, but has that defined them, or have they? You know, is it like the phoenix rising from the ashes? Were they bullied in school? Were they the A grade student? Is there anything like there that you can kind of learn from?
Yeah, I do think that there is a you know, the geeks will inherit the world. You know, that's sort of where that's happening with the Mark Zuckerbergs. And, you know, he's not a good-looking guy. You know, he probably had trouble at uni, and that's kind of where he got Facebook from, wasn't it? Just to see who's hot and who's not. That's kind of where his idea began. And I think what I'm seeing is the geeks shall rule. And the guys, and I say guys particularly because they do tend to dominate the tech world at the moment, they have got this empowerment now. You know, they think the coding skills I've got or the introversion that has really hindered me at school is now actually an asset. And I think that's a nice thing to see, that sometimes people who have had the bullying because they haven't been the jock, good at school, getting the girls, you know, they can now do something that is valuable and is attractive to others. And so I love that this is happening, that people's skills are being valued, not just the superficial aspect of who they are.
It's interesting because there was a and there's often the top people in e-commerce, the top companies in e-commerce, these lists that come out every year. It is amazing to me how many of them are actually run by women. It's quite a large, and I wrote a piece in the last 6 months, and it was, you know, one of the things I feel in this new world that we exist in, being e-commerce, there are no long-term archaic or traditional models or mindsets or you know this is the way it is. So therefore, women have been able to prosper, do well, do really, really well without having to battle these glass ceilings that did you get to meet many women in this process?
Yeah, I did. I was very conscious of that as well, because you can just fall into that trap of just interviewing the bigger names, and often it's the smaller names coming up who are as interesting. And just on the women thing, I think what's really important is I saw a woman from Microsoft being interviewed at C2. Do you know the C2 event? It's just this sort of Cirque du Soleil meets a conference. It's an interesting sort of conference model. Anyway, she was speaking, and she's a technologist, and she's American, and she was saying, it is so important that we get women into coding. And I know that's bandied around a lot, but the reason being is the people who make the artificial intelligence, the people who write the code, the people who create the voice-activated, you know, assistants, if that's all written by a man, then the ethos of that man and that cohort, that bro culture, as she called it, infiltrates the artificial intelligence, which is when we hear information coming back at us, it's through the prism of a male, you know, person. And she said, if we get more females into coding, more females into Silicon Valley, more females into that very specific area of coding and AI and machine learning and all the creation of the bots, the voice of those bots has to change because it's been made by women. And I thought it was a really interesting idea, because when you think about Elon Musk talking about AI and the power it's going to have, it can only be as powerful as the people who create it. And if those voices who are making it are from one dynamic or one demographic, being it, you know, the 23-year-old Silicon Valley bro, that's not healthy, mm-hmm. I think, for where we end up using this material, using this technology, but it's been created by one specific group.
We're going to call it quits for this week. We've hit a sweet topic, and we'll pick it up in a second.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.